I'm talking with Fred Brownfman. It's June 18th, 1996. We're on Bush Street. And Fred was born, what was your birthday?
March 18, 1942.
March 18, 1942, and you were born in?
New York City.
New York City. What did your family do?
My father's a textile merchant. Okay. New York City.
Uh-huh. And your mother?
Housewife.
Housewife. And did you go to high school in New York? Or?
Yeah, well, Great Neck.
Great Neck. So you grew up and you went to high school, and you went to college at?
University of Chicago.
University of Chicago. I was offered a fellowship there, by the way. Turned them down. The question we normally a lot of people we interview, some of them are brethren and Mennonites, and they, for them it's easy, they know why they wanted to do volunteer work, where that came from, sometimes, not always, but we always like to ask the people what do they think as they look back at their early life led them into something like the IBS, some formative experiences.
Well, you know, in my case, my things are always a little complicated, but basically, I would say I was always on the side of the oppressed. So I think, because my mother was like a very harsh woman when I was growing up, so I think I identified with people who were having trouble. And my thing was I wanted to join the civil rights movement, but my dad represented Southern textile mills and broke down on the kitchen table begging me not to join the civil rights movement. And if he had forbade me, I might have done it, but because he was begging me and crying, I couldn't bring myself to do it. So, when I was in college, I would have become basically your typical new left type. My friend says I would have wound up as a weatherman, which I suppose is certainly possible. But what happened with me was, so I couldn't join the civil rights movement, so I did the next best thing. I had a black girlfriend. All my friends were black when I was in college, and then I wound up going to Africa. And, you know, there was certainly, I was always a do-gooder type, but I probably wouldn't have gone abroad if it hadn't been for this weird set of events. And then when I was sitting in Africa, you know, I was turning 25, and it was clear my draft board might go after me, and I didn't want to go to prison. And certainly wasn't going to Vietnam, so for me it was Canada or, you know, some alternative. And since I was on this volunteer trip at that point, I actually wrote some articles that came to President Nyerere's attention in Tanzania. He asked for me to stay, and the American ambassador wrote a letter to my draft board, which they ignored. I didn't even look at it. And I, meanwhile, had applied to go to Malaysia. I think I was accepted to the Malaysia with the Peace Corps and Service Civil Internationale to Sri Lanka, then known as Ceylon. And then IBS was just this insurance policy. Oh, it's supported by AID. Like, if worse comes to worst, maybe I'll have a better chance of getting out of the Army. And I just heard about it and applied. And because I'd gone to Harvard and we had this year and a half of teaching in Africa, they sort of wanted me, and so they listed me as, you know, I was an educational advisor, not just a normal teacher was my title.
And in Tanzania, you had experience as evaluating?
No, there I was just a teacher.
You were just a teacher.
But IBS took a look at my resume and said, oh, the guy's already been a teacher, right. Plus he has this Master of Education from Harvard,
right.
So
right.
We'll make him an educational advisor to come to Laos.
How did you hear about IBS?
I have no idea.
No.
I mean, I'm sitting in a little village in the middle of Tanzania, and I might have heard of it before I left. I might have met somebody who mentioned it. I've wondered about that, because here I am, I was 1,000 miles inland, 50 miles from the nearest white man. I don't know how I could have heard of it.
What was the nearest town in Tanzania?
Mwanza?
Mwanza, I think.
On the shores of Lake Victoria.
It's one of the MVs of Red Grounding on a reef in Lake Victoria, and it's a huge loss of life.
I read that, yeah. The stories were coming out of Mwanza. Yeah. It's on its way into Mwanza. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's a whole other story.
Yes,
know,
absolutely.
Thing, yeah.
And someday I want to talk about that too.
Yeah.
So you thought you had already been accepted to the Peace Corps for
Malaysia.
And then IBS sent you a letter saying we'd like to have you as an educational advisor?
I probably wrote them a letter saying, oh, yeah, right. And then, yeah, I'm sorry. You've been selected to come. So I, at that point, I'm sitting in the middle of town. I'm thinking, why would they want me as an educational advisor? It wasn't clear from the letter. That's in Backfire, I think, the story. It's a long story. I can tell you if you're interested.
Oh, yes, we are, because, by the way, one of the, and this will be great on the tape, one of the things that I'd like to do in the long term for the tapes is I assign students the job of doing the transcripts. Not so much to be the official transcript, but so they get this experience of looking at this kind of source material, even if they're not history majors, and on issues of kind of primary ethical and moral and political issues, so that they can listen to real people thinking about real problems, because they get so little of that. Everything is dismissed as being politics or something like that. And so any kind of experience, those kind of out-of-country experiences and service experiences, I think are good. And whoever is transcribing this tape will, of course, understand now what the purpose of the assignment was.
Yeah, seriously, I'm sitting there and you know, the at that point it was like, I knew sort of, I was trying, you know, like, I knew there was a, some kind of activity in Laos, but it looked like, well, there's a neutral government, you know, the, obviously the U.S. is supporting the Royal Lao government, but at least it's theoretically neutral. Of course, at that point, you didn't know about the air war, and I definitely didn't want to go to Vietnam. I wouldn't have gone to Vietnam, partly because of being chicken and not wanting to be in the middle of the war, but partly I was absolutely opposed to the war by that point, which was 67. So there's no way. So a little bit of it was willful denial. It wasn't, my motives in going to Laos were fundamentally to get out of the army, and I was prepared to do anything to do that. I mean, I probably would have done anything. I was, I mean, that just was in the back of my mind since, you know, I turned 18. I mean, I just, there was no way I was going in the army. And I couldn't even imagine being, you know, an exile in Canada. So it was just like this no exit thing. It was always in the back of my mind. It was always a fear, you know, irrational perhaps. A lot of it was irrational. But it was an obsessive thing. So it was quite a, this whole thing was quite a trauma, this whole period of you know, I remember at one point when I was still in Tanzania, I took my draft card and stuck it in an envelope and was going to send it back to my draft board with a, this letter, and then I just didn't want to do that. So I just left it in my desk for the whole time while I was there. And, you know, constant, I don't remember right now, all the various, you know, trips going on. I mean, basically, you know, I wrote this long, impassioned letter to the draft board from Tanzania saying why I felt it was service to the national interest to remain in Tanzania. And, you know, it was this big deal where Julius Nyerere flew me by airplane to Dar es Salaam, and, you know, and this Minister of Education offered me the job. And I had this really great day on roughly February 17th, 1967. One of the high points of my life was running through the streets of Dar es Salaam for an entire day, stoned out of my mind with a good friend of mine named Lance, celebrating the Arusha Declaration with 100,000 Africans. We were the only two white guys on the street. And later on, we found out all the embassies had told the Westerners to stay off the streets because of possible danger. And we had, you know, we're having this ball, and everyone loved us, and, you know, it's great. And the next day, I'm getting off an airplane in Great Neck, New York, and it's freezing cold, and I don't have a coat, and I go into, like, deep freeze. I go to the IBS training in West Virginia. I've been accepted, and I kind of, you know, I'd sort of accepted, but I was holding back, because the theory was if the draft board doesn't make me 2A, it doesn't make me 1A, I'm 2A at that point. They accept my wanting to stay in Tanzania, I'd much rather do that. I'd even found this gorgeous woman with large breasts, a bar girl, and I was pretty far out there. We were going to move together to Dar es Salaam, and I had found this little house I wanted to stay in, and it's a whole trip. And, you know, suddenly, I mean, so I was like, to me, IBS was a downer. From the first day I heard about it, it was a nightmare, and, it, you know, basically, I was always anti the whole thing. I never liked it, and I was just doing to get out of the draft. I mean, you know, it was basically a, you know, bottom line.
And when you got to Harper's Ferry, and for the introductory material, How did that color the way you reacted to the briefings and the?
Totally. Yeah. I was just negative and hostile and just didn't like it. I didn't like anybody there. I didn't like the people. I mean, I would make friends with some of my fellow volunteers. But right away, I clocked this guy Gardner, who's a State Department guy. I was very hostile to the U.S. government at that point, funded by AID. A lot of them were right-wing. I mean, most of them were right-wing. They did. That's just a matter of fact. Vietnam was different. You know, the prototypical figure for Vietnam is Don, and the prototypical figure for Laos is Pop Buell. So, I mean, you know, it's just a different vibe. I was remembering that guy, Howie. I mean, he's a typical guy. You know, he constantly kind of his these little trips, like, you know, so-and-so was warned. Like, it's total bullshit. But, you know, as I said, Fred Schuyler was, but not the other two. So those guys were all like that. They were just, you know, they're nice guys. They're basically farm boys. The key thing I found out about farm boys is they secretly, I mean, they'll tell you, but they don't let it on. They think they're the greatest. They just think they're terrific. Everybody else is a total asshole. Guys who grew up on farms. That's the main thing I learned about.
It may be American, but just the guys who go to Yale think they're the best.
Right, a lot of people.
It goes both ways. Both end of the culture.
As I used to say, this is my typical attitude. I mean, since I'm on my spiritual path, I mean, I'm a little embarrassed, but I might as well try to recreate the atmosphere. At that point, my attitude was, one of my lines that I remember used to repeat to everyone was, I said, you know, I grew up in New York City, and I never met a farm boy. I was just thinking, gee, you know, I wish I knew somebody, you know, it'd be nice to know, you know, people from agricultural, you know, Kansas. University of Chicago, you don't meet them that much, you know. And I said, and then I found out why I never met them. They're all here in Laos. And I said, and I don't want to meet them. It's a real mistake, you know. So anyway, I mean, part of it was cultural, part of it was political, but I never really, you know, fit. Well, I never fit anywhere, but I never certainly didn't fit in that environment. And I was against the war, and, you know, the bottom line was in the IBS orientation in Harper's Ferry, there weren't a lot of people running around saying the war in Vietnam was a big mistake and America shouldn't be there. And I was totally morally outraged about the war, so I was just felt like I was, you know, kind of behind enemy lines here. To me, the enemy was the American government and its lackeys, and I just felt fucked that I had to do this thing that I didn't want to do because the alternative was, you know, as I used to put it, being fucked in the ass and going to jail. Going to jail and getting fucked in the ass or going to live in Canada. And I couldn't relate to either. Those were the three alternatives for me at that point.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. During the orientation, did you get the distinct impression that the briefing was meant to, like, the history of Southeast Asia was domino theory for you, that is pre-digested, that there was an American effort to stop communism in Asia?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It wasn't blatantly right-wing, but the whole orientation was that, we had a role in it. You know, that we were on the side of the angels. We were doing the right thing.
Well, the reason I let's come back to this, but there was an article in Adams and McCoy have this book about Laos, and John Llewellyn wrote this article called Reluctant Counterinsurgents. This was during the war. And then there's Backfire. And let me put it this way, historical memory is always composed of a great deal of fragments. For example, there were a lot of people who actually went off to Laos, and until they got there, they didn't realize they were working on USA money. That somehow that part of all the things that were so obvious to you were not obvious to them.
Right.
They served principally in southern Laos. They didn't know anything about the war in the north. Then they learned about the war in the north. And it began to erode everything that they were doing until they felt it would have been better off if they'd never gone. Yet that person, that IBS person, does not appear at all in any of this literature. In Roger's book, in this article by Llewellyn. And there is always an attempt, you know, to create a monolith that makes it easier when you're fighting something, to create that monolith. But I remember in your letter when you wrote, you know, they're just looking at this mole's eye view.
Yeah.
What's interesting is, and we're not, by the way, that concluding paragraph of your thing is exactly what we're doing.
Okay.
But the idea is the mole's eye view makes it very interesting because it shows that complicity isn't ever complete, that some of it's even unwitting, that they can end up with the same conclusions, and it becomes, gets a very full record, you know, by the time we're finished. And it's been very interesting thus far. I mean, Howard was like a unique... thus far, unique unto himself. The others are very different. I've only interviewed one farm boy that means anything.
Mm.
The rest were not. Very urban, very, very, very different approaches. Mm. But came to interest the same kind of conclusions for the most part. But you were you went to Harper's Ferry. You were in education, so you didn't get any immediate language training then in Laos.
I did when I got to Laos.
You did when you got to Laos, yeah. But not in the
I mean, basically, Harper's Ferry, I was that whole month. Well, first of all, when I was in Harper's Ferry, I hadn't yet gone on the draft board. So I did, actually, I remember leaving the training, going to the draft board, and actually coming back either to the training or down to Washington. Mm-hmm. So I was in total shock. I mean, like, as far as I knew, I might be on my way to prison in Canada. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, I didn't know if they would accept my IBS thing. So I was, and also I was just cold. I was just physically... cold. When I'd gotten off the plane from Tanzania, I got chilled. And for those 30 days, I still remember, I just felt, imagine, it was like being in an icebox for 30 days. Plus, it was totally surrealistic. You know, I was living in a little village in Tanzania with no water or electricity, come back to America for a month, and then go off to Laos for 4 years. So it was like 2 years here, 4 years there, and you got this 30-day surrealistic pillow in between. You know, it was totally, you know, crazy.
So you felt, you already felt you were alienated, angry, dissatisfied.
Miserable. I felt victimized. More than, less than angry at that point. I just felt sorry for myself. Like I was this complete victim. And I couldn't believe this was happening. You know, especially when I was very happy in town. And I'm not high. You know, Nyerere is going to make, I got my girlfriend. Nyerere is going to give me this great job. And suddenly I'm on my way. The fucking Laos, you know.
Yes, especially since, but the interesting thing is you would have been one of the very few Europeans in all of Tanzania.
Well, I would have been a high advisor. I might not have lasted, actually, but at that point I was scheduled to be this very high advisor. Mm-hmm. To Nyerere.
But, which is another story, but when you, when you came back from the draft board and you finished the IVS, introductory training, and then you immediately went off. You went off with a group.
Yeah.
Do you remember anyone who was in your same team?
Just Sally Benson, but she wasn't. I'm not sure she was in education, or she was at Harper's Ferry. She may have been. I think they went to Vietnam. Somehow, for some reason, I made friends with Sally, and uh-huh. She's the, because I knew her later. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. Oh, and I remember one guy, lovely guy, Steve Hodges, who was also Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But he went off to. He did go to Canada. You know, basically, I remember, I mean, that was part of my whole story, was I never had any connection, almost, with anyone in IVS, on a personal level. I mean, they weren't on my, I mean, I had friends there, but they weren't on my wavelength. I remember Larry Olson became close to when I was in Laos. Chandler Edwards was one of the guys that got killed. I knew Art Stillman, not as well. And then I had a really funny story. I was in Laos in 93. I went back for the first time in 25 years. And I'm walking down the street, and I hear this bellow, you know, Fred Bransman, you know. And I look up. I'm not going to mention the guy's name, although the story is so funny. But you know, you'll probably run across him at some point. Anyway, he goes, Fred Bransman, oh, my God. And this guy, you know, just jumps out, and he's pumping my hand. And he goes, you're bowing at my feet. That you're... You changed my life, you know, you're just the most important person in my life, you know, oh God, it's just so great, I've never forgotten you, and I couldn't remember this guy's name, right? Mm-hmm. So we go out to have lunch. I'm thinking, you know, how did I change his life? Gee, did I get him into, you know, Laotian culture, you know, did I, because, you know, in the street he didn't explain how, and mm-hmm. did I, you know, maybe I turn him on politically, you know, it's really, you know, I was really feeling good about myself. We sit down to lunch and he goes, you know, he said, Before I came to Laos, I was scared to death of women. I never touched a woman. You were the one who introduced me to the bar girls. It goes on for hours. Apparently our entire relationship, which I couldn't even remember, was built around getting stoned and going to bars, and, you know, by helping him work through it. Then he becomes this, you know, this compulsive sex addict type thing for the next 20 years. I mean, this wasn't actually that wonderful a relationship. Anyway, those are my relationships.
Yes.
So I never was that close until the end. I got close to this guy, Walt Haney, and he's in Voices from the Planet of Jars. In the appendix, he wrote a little thing sort of mildly criticizing the bombing of the refugees. And you might want to talk to him. He was an interesting guy. Have you come across him?
Not yet. Well, he's not in my region. He's not on the West Coast, apparently.
But then he did this really weird thing. He never contacted me when he got back. I got back first. And then he wrote a review of Voices from the Plain of Jars where he chose, it was for the Post, it was the only negative review he got. And he chose, to say that I had included a quote from a letter from Don Rong saying the refugees in Vientiane Plain were dying and, you know, sort of were in very bad shape and were ill and were dying. And he sort of wrote very, you know, kind of nastily about how I had exaggerated things and, you know, and it sort of was a negative review. And I always went like, how come this guy, I thought he was one of my good friends. And then I started to wonder, well, gee, maybe he was actually, then I got paranoid that could he have been a conservative who pretended to befriend me, wasn't really my friend, or was he actually just a good guy and got annoyed at what that he did feel? I don't know. But if you run across him, I'd like to, I've often wondered about that. Anyway, so then I wound up in Laos, and I was, you know, my story really didn't involve that much IBS. I stayed away. I didn't like it. So I, and you better go ahead and ask your question.
Well, the thing is that what happened to you was rather unique when you got there. It's really better in your own words anyway. But when you arrived there, you had an assignment, but the assignment disappeared, essentially. It was a no-go. But why don't you just go over that briefly?
Just since you asked, I did get loud training when I first got there. And immediately, my attitude was, I don't want anything to do with these, but I took one look at that AID compound with the, jukeboxes and dances and, you know, all that stuff and golf courses and whatever. I mean, it just wasn't me. So I was on my Tanzania because I'm going to go live with Laotians. So I was actually assigned to live at Dom Dolp, the teacher college. And I simply went over there. I had just arrived. I didn't know a thing about it. And went found the nearest village to Dom Dolp, rented a house, and just told everyone I was going to start living there, and learned, I must say that I have this, I'm not any great genius in anything, but I have this teeny little ability, which is I can really learn an incredible amount of any language in an incredible short period of time. So I took the training, and by the end of the training, everyone's like amazed how well I could speak it, just like, you know, a month or something. And then I went out and lived in this village, and actually hired a guy who spoke, actually I spoke pretty good French then, so I hired a guy who spoke French and Lao. And within 3 months I was quite fluent in Laotian, living in this village on my own. And so my big thing was to go native, learn Laotian, and I immediately liked Laotian people. So I started wearing my black Viet Cong costume and my long hair and all this. And I was just kind of right away from the beginning, I just opted out. And now I become friends with June Pulcini. But in those days I'd go visit her and it's just like, you know, I would be making her nervous. And, you know, it's just like, and even the people who are really good people I couldn't connect with. And there were a lot of people who I just took one look at me and just went, you know. So I was like the distinct oddball then. They used to call me Pouvian, the Laotian. So that was my name. So I just went Lao, basically, comes down to it. Didn't really hang out very much with the IBS types. I mean, somewhat, but not that much. But my big dynamic in terms of IBS was with this guy Wilder, and Bernie Wilder was the head of the IBS education department. And there was another guy, I guess, who was the head of the CD department or something, and then there'd be a rural development. I guess there was one overall chief. Is that the structure? You know? You don't know their names, but you didn't know their names.
No. Just work, that's one. That's for. I want to get into the.
Yeah, because I was in education. The real action was with the rural development types. So I, and the education types were mainly at Dundalk or something. So I was a total anomaly. So there's another way I didn't quite fit in. So I'm coming there, you know, I don't actually know what my job is. I mean, my whole thing was draft. I'm not even thinking about Laos or anything until I got off the plane. And I go into the compound. And actually, Lauren was the guy's, RD guy's name, I think. If I remember, I think Bernie picked me up. I may have even had a drink with Bernie and Lauren for some reason. I remember that. But I definitely remember Bernie. And, you know, Bernie is being, you know, kind of friendly, making these stupid little jokes all the time. And I'm like in total shock kind of thing. And he says, well, you're going to be an educational advisor. I said, what is that all about, brother? What's my job? And he says, well, I want you to talk to Dr. Hall. You're really going to be reporting directly to Dr. Ralph Hall. He said, you know, I'm not going to have that much to do with you, but it's my understanding you're going to be making, Dr. Hall is in charge of secondary education, and he wants you to study primary education, because they're the ones feeding into the secondary, and he needs to know something about primary. Fine, I don't know a thing. This all happens, I think, within the first, this part of the story happened certainly within 72 hours after arriving in Laos, and quite possibly within 24 hours of arriving in Laos, where I'm soaking wet. First thing happened, I got off the airplane, it was the Pine Ride of New Year, and they dumped water all over me. And I remember as I'm coming in, I get totally soaked. I don't know where you're soaked. Soaked with water. You know, somebody dumps this water, you know, everybody laughs, you know. And so I'm, you know, and they introduced me to Dr. Hall, and, you know, this nice-looking guy, kind of a little military, a little white mustache, very upright, very rigid. And he says, hi, Fred, you know, knew all about me, you know, you're going to be an educational advisor. He says, very casual. He says, you know, I'm in charge of secondary school education. I have this big budget, and everything's me, I'm blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it turned out like the Lao government had a budget, but it was all sort of going to pay teachers' salaries. So books, curriculum, teacher training, buildings, anything. I mean, AID's budget was about three times that of the Lao budget in the first place. Plus, anything other than teacher salary was being done by the Americans, so we were really in charge of the whole school system. So it was, and he was really the czar of education for Laos, determining what, you know, that generation of school kids learned in school. And he says, you know, Dr. Little is in charge of primary school education, and, you know, you'll be making this study of secondary school education. And Dr. Andrus is in charge of the whole thing. So at some point in that first 24, 48 hours, he says, let me take you over to Dr. Andrew or something. And suddenly I find myself in this meeting. That's all I remember. There were like 10 or 12 people in the meeting, and the key people were Dr. Andrews, Dr. Little, and Dr. Hall. And Dr. Andrews turns to me and asks me what I remember thinking after he asked me, how come he doesn't know? And the question was, so Fred, what are you going to be doing here? And I go, oh, well, my understanding is that I'm going to be making a study of primary school education in Laos. And all of a sudden, this guy, he looked like a big bullfrog, was Dr. Little. He goes, what did you say? And I said, well, my understanding is that I'm going to be making a study of primary school education in Laos. And he says, son, I'm in charge of primary school education in Laos, and I don't know anything about you. What do you mean you're going to be making a study of primary school education in Laos? What do you know about primary school education? And I said, well, sir, and he interrupts. He goes, son, I'm 62 years old. I'm a former, you know, superintendent of schools of St. Louis, Missouri, where I spent 25 years teaching, being a principal and a superintendent of a school system of 60,000 students. I then went to Malaysia where I ran the school system for 12 years, and I went to Thailand. I set up the entire program there. And he goes to this long list. I always remember looking at him. He goes, so son, what can you tell me that I don't already know? And then when I get out, Dr. Hall is pissed at me.
Yes.
Like, why did you say that, Fred? And, you know, so that was like the beginning. You know, this is already, so I'm in the war zone. I left Pennsylvania. I almost got drafted, and now I'm in the middle of this thing that I still don't know what's going on, right? So finally, over time, I realize what's going on is Dr. Andrus is leaving. And Dr. Hall and Dr. Little are competing for his job.
Yeah.
So Dr. Hall has brought me from Tanzania to get information that he can use against Dr. Little. And I'm going to be his spy. Dr. Little, of course, immediately figured that one out and goes, why should I let this guy be his spy? So he refuses to let me go to any schools. I mean, not go into a school and do, you know, so I'm sitting there like, you know, and then somewhere along the line, I think what it was actually I'd fallen in love with this Thai Lao woman who was the, who was teaching at my English school or something, I don't know, as a matter of fact, I met her well, and she was going down this little village for the summer called, I don't remember, it's probably in the book, I can't remember the name, Lahana. So those 6 weeks were about the happiest 6 weeks of my life. So I remember, let me see, what would the sequence be? It was like, okay, somehow, let's see, I got there in April or May. Yeah, I know what it was. So the compromise
this is April and May
of 67. So this bureaucratic infighting, I'm just chewing my nails and being chowned, unable. I'm one of these people, I couldn't work at that point. I felt like, why am I here kind of thing. And so I really wanted to do this job. And Dr. Hall starts telling me he's going to handle it, but I have to be patient. That's what it was. So finally, by now it's already the summer. You know, they've diddled. But I hear that, oh, during the summer, they take primary school teachers and they train them. They give them these summer school classes. And I think it may have been the secondary teacher. Anyway, for some reason, I could get away. This is coming back to me. So that I remember. So then I go in the summer, and I'm very intent when I do these things. So I go around these summer classes, and I really get into it. And they make it clear to me that I'm getting into the Lao American dynamic. So I'm the only American in these summer school classes. So they decide I'm a spy for the Americans. So I keep promising them, and I get them all agree that I can come to their schools in the fall. And that was the whole idea, I'd make contact with all the principals and teachers. But they keep saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? I said, well, I'm going to write a report, and I'm going to get you the report, and then you'll know that I'm on the up and up. That's right. Yeah. And somewhere in there, now this is interesting, I can't remember which came first. Lahanam came first or Lahanam came after that? Lahanam must have come after that. So somehow I wind up in Lahanam, and I think what it was is this girl that I was in love with was going to be in Lahanam for a couple of months, and so I convinced Dr. Hall and Dr. Little to just let me go there. I'd study one school intensively. And that must have been what it was. So anyway, I wound up in Lahanam, and I'm theoretically studying the school. That was a whole, that's a real story. That's a very interesting story. We'll get to that for a moment. And I'll finish the thread here. So I stayed in Lahanam, and then in the middle of all that, my congressman, Lester Wolf, comes out, and my mother has gone to see him to say that she must see her son, Freddie, when he goes to Laos, because she's worried sick about me. So I get this call. I'm in Lahanam, and they fly me all the way up to Vientiane to meet my congressman, and okay, I see, because they're two separate stories. I've got this now. Excuse me. Prior to that, we'll get back to Lao in a moment. So I get back from the summer school. That's what it was, right? I get back from the summer school. I write this big report. I go to the trouble of getting the whole thing translated into Laotian, which was not easy. And, you know, so I'm sitting there with this 50-page report in Laotian that we've agreed to send out. My frame of reference at that point is all I care about. There may be a war going on, but I want to do my job, and to do that, I've got to prove to these Laotian principals that. So, and Dr. Little refuses to send out the report. So that was the period when, the second period, when Dr. Hall has befriended me and is telling me he'll take care of it, but I have to be patient. So the weeks are passing. I'm not doing anything. That may have been somehow in there may have been when the Slahanin thing was going down, if I remember. Somehow it's all mixed up in my mind right now. And on a Saturday morning, I go in there, and I'm walking past Dr. Andrus's office. This lovely fellow, I mean, he's a buncular type, you know. And Fred, come on in. I haven't talked to you for a while. How are you doing? You know, when I sit down, how are you doing? How are things? I say, sir, you know, I'm really enjoying my stay here, and I spent this wonderful time at these summer schools for teachers, you know, but I've written this big report, and I really want to get it out, and, you know, Dr. Little won't send us out this report, and because we can't send out the report, I can't go visit these schools, and I'm just sitting here, and I, you know, it's really important, you know, you really got to help me out. He says, well, it's a straight, he goes, no problem. Monday morning, bright and early, I'm going to get Dr. Hall and Dr. Anderson here. Dr. Little in here. We'll resolve it, Fred. Don't you worry about things. They're patting me on the shoulder. He's a bunkular, nice guy. You know, got a kick out of my anguish, I guess. So at that point, I leave the meeting from Dr. Andrus, and I go into Dr. Hall's office, and I go, oh, Dr. Hall, good news. I said, you know, I was just into Dr. Andrus's office, and he says we're going to get this thing all, you know, unjammed. You know, he says, our report's going out, kind of, yahoo, kind of thing. Dr. Hall looks at me in total shock and goes, you did what? And I said, well, I just walked in and told him. He says, oh, he says, Fred, just a moment. And he gets up, and he closes the door, and he walks back very slowly to his desk. And he leans across the table and looks at me for, about, you know, it seemed like an hour. I'm sure it was only about a minute. And he goes, Fred, let me ask you a question. Oh, that's right. He says, Fred, I want you to know that I will go to no such meeting on Monday. He said, but Dr. Hall, I mean, we've been wanting to get this report out. He says, Fred, I will go to no such meeting. But Dr. Hall, he says, Fred, let's get something straight here. You went around my back. You thought you could do it better than me. So you have your meeting with Dr. Andrus if you want. I'm not going to any such meeting. I mean, but sir, I mean, and he goes, Fred, let me ask you a question. I said, what's that? He says, do you know what the Viet Cong do to a man when they capture him? I said, no, sir. He said, they cut off his balls with a hunting knife, Fred. They cut off his balls with a hunting knife. And I go, what? I said, yes, sir. And he goes, you think about that, Fred. You think about it. And I go, I will, sir. I'll think about that. And I left the room. So it was around then that I decided to go to Lahanam and leave, you know, this catch-22 crazy situation. Go down to Lahanam, you know, really get into it then, right? What was actually a terrific report. This was more for the eyes of AID. My first report never got distributed, but and basic my passion at that point was I noticed that we, quote unquote, whatever we are, the Americans are spending all this money to teach these kids French and English, actually English. So to skim off the cream of the crop will become part of the AID and Royal Lao government apparatus. And meanwhile, you know, my passion, which I'd started back in Tanzania, was 80% of these kids were going to leave at grade 6 or leave at grade 8 and would not be prepared to go back into their villages. And yet would not want to go back because they would have had this little taste. But so I had a whole, you know, 20 suggestions for how to reorient the curriculum to, you know, the primary school curriculum shouldn't have any foreign languages and should teach them agriculture in Laotian and all this good stuff. I mean, that was my prepare them community development, you know, about 20 suggestions along that line, critiques of everything that was going on. And I give the report, you know, to probably Hall. I know I gave it to Hall. I don't know if I gave it to Andrus directly or not. And, you know, don't hear anything. And it was around that time that the congressman showed up. So I'm called up, talking to the congressman, Dr. Mendenhall, who was the head of the whole program. He's actually a big guy, Joseph Mendenhall, head of AID Laos, used to be either before or after became the head of AID Vietnam. He comes in, and Lester introduces me to him, the congressman, and we're talking. And I said, by the way, and Lester, you know, they're about to go up to Samtong, and I ask if I can come along for the ride. And they agree to let me go. But that's another story. But we're going to stay with the IVS stuff. So at that point, I go up there and I get to know Mendenhall a little bit. And I mention I've done this report. So he says, oh, great, I would love to read that report. So I said, terrific, sir. And I give him a copy of my report. You know. And maybe a week passes, and Dr. Hall calls me into his office and sits down, and very friendly, very avuncular sort of thing for him. He goes, Fred, he says, I've just written I just sent off a very interesting letter I think you'd find quite interesting. I said, oh, great. You know, so he hands me this letter, and it's from Dr. Hall to Joseph Mendenhall saying, dear Dr. Mendenhall, thank you for sending me Fred Braffman's report with its 18 suggestions. As you've requested, here are my responses to his 18 suggestions. And he just went through one by one, saying why it couldn't be done or why it was wrong. And at the end of the letter, he says, I've discussed each of these suggestions with Fred, who is very naive and inexperienced, and he agrees that he's naive and inexperienced and officially withdraws all of his suggestions. And it's signed and dated and has been sent off. So I'm looking at this thing in complete shock, you know. And he says, hey Fred, did I ever tell you about this IVS volunteer named so-and-so, or Bob, whatever? And I said, no. And he says, yeah. He said, it kind of reminds me of you. He was here a couple of years ago. He said, he was just like you, actually, just a real wise ass, you know, a real troublemaker, just like you. And he said, he's very friendly. He's telling some little story. He goes, you know, it's really interesting what happened there. You know, he was giving me problems, and I got him kicked out of here and got him sent back to America. He says, but, you know, I knew he was a malingerer just like you. He didn't want to go in the Army. And he said, so what I did is I wrote his draft board once a month until they drafted him. He says, darnest thing, I was so sad. He said, a couple of months ago, I got a letter that he was killed in Vietnam, you know. And, he says, he looks across the table and says, now, Fred, let me tell you something. You're not fooling me one bit. I know what's going on with you. And he says, let's get something straight. You are going to become an English teacher in Don Doc. And you are not going to cause me any trouble. And if you do cause me trouble, I'm going to not only get you out of here, I'm going to not even kick you out of here. Just like old Bob, I'm going to make sure you wind up in Vietnam. And you'll probably end up in a body bag. So you just think about that kind of thing. So I leave the room, you know, and I go see Wilder after think about it for a day or two. And at that point, my second biggest passion in life, besides getting my reports out, was I didn't want to be an English teacher. It was just, to me, that was just, I wouldn't do it. So I propose to Wilder a deal. I said, look, you know, if you want to list me as teaching on the books at Don Doc, that's fine with me. He said, I don't want to have anything to do with Dr. Hall. And he says, but you don't want me calling my congressman and causing a lot of trouble. So let's, he says, I know I got another year and a half here. I'll make you a deal. You let me do what I want to do. I'll be an education advisor. I'll live in my village. I won't bother you. You don't have to bother me. I'll just do my own thing. You know, I'm into rural development. You know, I want to write a textbook on agriculture to teach Laotians and Laotians. I'll do that. And you have my word that I'm not going to cause any problems, you know, or start fighting Dr. Hall or write my congressman. He's not going to bother me. And let's just do that. And, you know, and Wilder came back. You know, it was like a real thing. I mean, he probably would deny it, but he came back and said, okay, if you don't cause us problems, we won't cause you problems, basically. So this is like maybe half a year into this, my 2 years and 2 months with IVS. And so what I did for the next year and a half was basically live in my village. At that point I was in love with this beautiful Vietnamese girl, and I would go downtown all the time and sort of chase her. We didn't have a sexual relationship the first year, so I would wind up going to these bars at night, which I'm not particularly proud of. And then so I had this sort of dual life where I'd live in the village, And then, you know, I took my work seriously, and I did a lot of stuff. Like, I basically had three projects. One is I got this garden started in the school, and one is I took a set of teachers from Don Doak and made a big, set up a whole program to train them in community development down in Thailand. And the big thing I did is I spent a lot of time writing I often wonder what the hell ever happened to it. Not only did I write a 500-page textbook to teach, which I still think is a great idea, to teach six, primary school students agriculture and also arithmetic and things, but all in Laotian, but I got an artist, and we turned it into like a comic book thing. So we had this 500-page book, most of which was illustrated, and I just, spent a year of my life on that, and I'm sure it never threw in the wastebasket when I handed it in, but that's sort of how I did my tour. And then in my spare time, even while I was still with IVS, as I got there, as I learned the language, as I got more comfortable, I made friends with like Dan Berrigan and Howard Zinn. See, everyone would come through on their way to Hanoi, and I, even though I was with IVS, I would go to their hotel and make friends with them and tell them all the little stuff I was starting to pick up about the war, my spare time. But I worked at, actually it's kind of like now, I worked at my own schedule, did what I felt like doing, and, didn't make any public noise about the war. I befriended this Russian couple, which is a pretty outrageous thing to do at that point, given the climate there. I just did my own thing, for a year and a half.
What about that... The infamous
meeting. Right, yeah.
Yes.
So,
how did that
was near the end of my stay there, and I used to actually, I went there admiring the communists and not liking not only the United States, but not liking the Royal Lao government or the South Vietnamese government. When I got there, I saw nothing ever in one moment to disabuse me of that fundamental position. That is, I was obviously exposed to all the Royal Lao government corruption. My village was called the Village of the Deep Pond, Ban Sapang Muk. This pond had been taken away by the richest guy in the village and wouldn't let the other villagers use it. And he had worked out a deal with the government downtown. The Royal Lao Government soldiers were, they were young guys, but they were basically drinking, and, I talked to them all the time, everywhere we run into them. They were always joking about, girls. That was the big thing, sex. And I always remember the very first time, there was this Pathet Lao compound downtown, and the very first time, it was like a very risque thing to do, not too many Americans did, but they would show movies every Friday night. And at one point, I got my guts up and went to see one of their movies, and I just always remembered the Laotian soldiers there were very serious and talked about the Middle East and, political affairs, and didn't make jokes about women and giggle and all this crap, And right away, I was very impressed, with the soldiers as soldiers. And so I was, I'd gone there with that bias, certainly towards the Viet Cong. I don't know if I had... Of course, I wouldn't have known much about Pathet Lao, but slowly the things I was picking up, I'd pick up that, the story in the Roger book that I really thought it was important to teach kids agriculture in the schools, and the Pathet Lao were doing that. And,
how did you find out the Pathet Lao were doing that?
See, I found a lot about the Pathet Lao later, after I left IVS. I don't know at that point, maybe, somebody mentioned that Pop Buell had found these textbooks, I don't know, or... maybe I would ask the soldiers about it, like, do you teach agriculture? And they'd say yes, or, during my two years and 2 months with IBS, I didn't know much about the Pathet Lao. But, the proof of that was that when I read those articles from Jacques de Cornois that in the Le Monde, in July 69, right when I was leaving IVS, the first thing I did was run off to Paris because I wanted to go to Pathet Lao zones to see if I could, if this was right after I left IVS, because I didn't know and I wanted to know. I didn't claim to be any big expert. I was picking stuff up. I knew the government we were supporting was corrupt. I had the little I was hearing about the Pathet Lao was pretty positive. But I didn't know very much about them yet, or really know anything about the bombing or the war at that point while I was with IBS. But anyway, so I used to live in this village, and, you know, at that point, dope was legal in Laos, and I was a big pothead. So everybody used to visit my village. You know, everybody have a great time. You know, we'd eat dinner with the old man, and I'd tell him. I knew a lot about Laotian culture, and this family I was living with, great. You know, the old man was this wonderful person. There was an article in the Atlantic that my reporter friend, I brought like dozens of people to this village, all sorts of people, I mean, reporters, and, you know, Jack Kornfield was founder of Buddhism in America and stuff, and, you know, different people. One of them was this guy, Chandler Edwards, who was a friend of mine, was an IBS volunteer. And he's a lovely guy, he's a Quaker, and, you know, we used to have these arguments, and I would always support, I mean, I remember arguing with Chandler Edwards and saying, we're supporting the wrong side, the path that Laos should win this battle, you know. And he was going like, you know, I'm not political, I don't want to deal with that, I'm not going to say you're wrong, but, you know, I'm not here for that. I mean, I came here to have a good time, let's get out of the military. What I know is I'm helping these villagers, and that's what's important. And they appreciate it, and that's all I care about. You know, we discuss it. And then he got killed on a motorcycle. You know, I mean, he went down to Champasak, and about 2 weeks after he got back from, you know, a week, I pick up the paper one day, and Chandler Edwards has been killed. You know, so I got pretty upset about that. You hear the song? I wrote a song about it. I don't know if I should sing it.
Just go ahead.
Would you have me sing it?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, what is an oral history if it's not oral? Okay.
This is sung to the tune of Bob Dylan's, "While Riding on a Train Going West, I Fell Asleep, Where to Take My Rest."
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I Had a Dream. That's the song. Bob Dylan's Dream, I think it's called. That's the song. Picked up a newspaper one sunny day to see what the words on the front page would say. Chandler Edwards been killed, they said. Couldn't quite believe what I just read. Thoughts ran back to a Vientiane village porch, to a first talk had by the light of a torch, to jokes told and ideas expressed about war and peace, living and death. If killing is right, he'd said with a smile, then so is stealing or gangbanging in style. I'd be dead for I'd kill another. Even in war, every man's a keeper and a brother. And yes, I know that we're on the wrong side, but there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. Anyway, am I worried? Oh, not that much. Anyway, it's a question of luck. Your luck is kind of like a golden chain, like the wind, the light, the heat, the rain. Where it starts and oh, where it ends, you'll never ever figure out, my friend. Just follow that chain wherever it goes, to Burma, China, Vietnam, Laos, and stay as long as it'll take to learn what you want to learn. What you wanna make. From Vientiane, a motorcycle flew under the sun, past rivers and valleys and hills it did run, on and on a winding road led to a Laotian village by a riverbed. In Champatak it stayed for a while, after so many a road and so many a while, to rest under a wooden hut and gather up strength for the next time out. But as it happened, the next time never came. It rusted and dusted, waiting in vain for gold chains break and old roads do bend. And like it was said, you never know when. Now Chandler Edwards has been this way, has passed this way. Just why or how, I can't really say. Where he was going and oh, where he went, I never ever really did get. But sometime since then the wind's blown and it's rained, and I've thought about killing and golden chains. And I kinda wish that, oh, he was still here. It might make it all seem a little more clear. So, Chandler Edwards got killed. And then shortly after that, the annual meeting for IBS is coming up again. And I'm going, oh. Why don't we invite Deepathit Lal to our annual meeting? Now, my argument was that, hey, they have as much a claim to this as the stupid Royal Lao government, but obviously that wouldn't get you very far. So I made the argument also that, they just killed Chandler Edwards, and he was an IBS volunteer. They make no distinction between IBS volunteers and soldiers and CIA personnel and Air Force personnel, and just for our own survival, we ought to make it clear that we're different. And the most symbolic way to do that would be to invite Deepathit Lal to our annual meeting. So there's this one, I remember there's one meeting with most of the volunteers. I'm sure they all went there. And it was hot and heavy debate, and I'm sure I was the leader of the invite Deepathit Lal forces, and my main argument was, just pure. I mean, I would give my principled arguments, but then the main argument was, look, guys, does anyone in this room want to have blood on the hands of what are you talking about? I mean, we all came here. We're supposedly a volunteer group. Yes, we're funded by AID, but either we're not different, and then we have no, we should stop bellyaching if they kill us all, or we are. I mean, we're all complaining that they're killing us. So why don't we show that we're different? And I won the argument by a vote, but it was a vote and it was official, it was democratic and so forth. And then a couple of weeks later, this Arthur Gardner, was this old super muniary or whatever he was from the State Department, old, apparatchik, shows up, former apparatchik, I guess he was a big shot, AID official. And, we have this meeting, and I'm at the meeting. I was one of the few volunteers. It was behind closed doors. It was just the leadership, but to discuss this issue. And since I was the most vociferous person providing the debate, he just said no. He said absolutely not. We're not inviting the Deepathit Lal, and that's that. And he didn't even give any real arguments for it. He just said we're not going to do it. That's not going to happen. And I just remembered it at one, the most dramatic point in the meeting. I said, look, after it was clear that he wasn't going to budge, I said, well, Dr. Gardner, I said, I just want you to look around this room, and I want you to look each person in the face. I said, because there's a very good chance that within the next several months, one or more of them is going to be dead, and their blood is going to be on your hands. In my opinion, their blood will be, you could have prevented this, and you didn't do it. Everybody's in shock because I'm talking about them dying, Walk out of the room, and a month or two later, Art Stillman's killed. I don't know if. I realized just recently talking to Don that he claims that when the IVS leadership in Vietnam had a similar to do, I don't know what the issue was, they decided to resign en masse. So it's ironic that if Art Stillman had either resigned individually or the whole team there had threatened to resign, either they would have resigned and he would still be alive, or, they would have made Mr. Gardner back down. And we would have invited Deepathit Lal to the meeting and it might have made a difference, I don't know. But in any event, that's obviously speculation. And That was kind of near the end of my tour. Needless to say, that was my final burning of the bridges with IBS. You know, and after that, I had nothing good to say about them. And when I did leave in June, I came there in March '67, I was finished in March '69, but I stayed for 2 more months because I was so dedicated to my agricultural textbook. I needed 2 months to get it finished. When I left in June '69, you know, I stayed there another year and a half when things really got intense, and I never even dealt with IBS. I never talked to anybody. Never. The only person I really liked there, if you come across them, left. You know Larry Elson? Have you heard about him anymore? He'll be in East.
Olson, I think he's on the list. Yeah, I don't think I'm.
If you could get me to have him remember, he was the only guy I liked there. He was just this wonderful. He's a farm guy, but he was pure Laotian. You wouldn't know he wasn't Laotian. His way of speaking Laotian was great. He spoke it much better than anyone else. And just loved the Laotian people. And he wasn't political, but he was my. I remember while I was there, he was the guy I seen. I kind of liked. I just glom on to people like that. I kind of liked him the best. I remember after that one little incident that came up recently because I met his former sister-in-law. But I remember there's a guy named Peter Lydon who you could talk to. Probably interesting. I'm told he's in Berkeley. He's a young political officer for the American Embassy. Very ambitious, politically ambitious. And I remember shortly after this IBS. Meeting in Broglio, I was at a coffee shop, and he had always been like my friend, and I'm against the war too, and all this good stuff. And we get talking, and I tell him the whole story. Of course, at that point, you can imagine how I was really head up about it, and I'm sure I went on for hours about every little detail of the story, you know. And at the end of the story, we're sitting there, we're talking, very interested, and asking all these questions, and suddenly I said, by the way, Peter, I said, you aren't going to report this story to you. American Embassy, are you? Shows by naivete, 2 years after that. And I'll never forget, he goes, well. And then I go on for an hour about, you know, because I was paranoid at that point that I had figured, I didn't know if the embassy actually, it seems like they didn't since he was so interested, knew this whole story, and I, you know, didn't want to finger myself I was pretty paranoid about, you know. But I can tell you, Mark, the key point of the story to me, and that's why I think, I wrote down a letter, I don't know if I give you a copy of it, but I just said, you know, it's just factually not true that for every Pop Ewell there was a Fred Braffman in Laos. Maybe that's what he wrote me in his letter. That may be true for Vietnam, but it just wasn't true for Laos. There was one me, there was a half of me with Walt, I guess, that he did take a stand writing that letter.
Well, there were all those who voted with you on the path of Laos.
Yeah, although I think it was mainly on security grounds. I don't think they had very much to say about the. I don't think it was a political vote.
Well, we'll come back to that. Yeah. In fact, we are. That's the next thing I want to discuss.
The point I want to sum up my 2 years to us is I don't remember feeling, even though I love Larry Elson as a person, I didn't feel there was a single person there, with the 50% exception of Walt, who was actually opposed to the killing, the war, who, if they knew about Royal Laos government corruption and didn't have anything good to say about the Royal Laos government, who took that to a political level and said, therefore, we shouldn't be supporting these people. So I always felt very isolated, very unhappy on that. I didn't have any comrades or, you know, Fred. People would really support me on this while I was there. The most you might get is somebody,